picturing. Are you a cool person? Are you? Raise your hand if you are.
I imagine that you're watching this podcast. So you are. You are a cool person.
Watching?
Every one of our listeners is outside the windows right now. I know you didn't realize it, but I sure did.
All the rest of our listeners, except for you, are outside our windows at this moment. Get over here. Get over here and watch us record. It's more fun than watching paint dry, maybe. Hey, everybody, I'm Maria. I'm one of your amateurs on Magic the Amateur.
Hey, guys. I'm Megan. I'm another person on this podcast.
Megan took a second before she said that because she's eating a Pop-Tart. Megan?
That's right.
Where's your sense of decorum?
I don't have one.
Fine. Megan and I learned to play this amazing game almost 2 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
We're almost at the two-year mark.
We're going to have an anniversary.
Yeah, we did a special show for our anniversary, our 1 year anniversary last year.
That's right.
So maybe we'll do another special show for our 2 year anniversary this year.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
We'll be the terrible twos.
Yeah, we will. The podcast is just going to get really terrible.
We're going to throw a lot of tantrums.
Exactly. We're just going to rant about like just really stupid things.
And I will be teething. So it's going to be a horrible experience for everybody.
I'm glad that you'll finally have teeth, though, because honestly, that's been creeping me out.
Why, Megan? Do you want to watch me eat a banana with my gums?
No, I really, really don't.
Well, everybody, we have a great show for you this week. We're going to talk Cons of Tarkir. The pre-release just happened. Are you guys still riding high? I know I am on a wave of euphoria from Cons of Tarkir. It's an awesome set. We're going to go over the rules with our special guest, Judge Rob, who joins us to explain all the things that we don't know, us common folk, every time a new set is released. We're also going to chat about the pre-release, talk about some of our overperformers, some of our underperforming cards, and new prices at GPs. That's so much stuff, I just might faint.
Please don't. That'll be really counterproductive to talking about all those things.
Will you finish that Pop-Tart?
I'm working on it. Don't rush me. As Maria mentioned, we have special guest Judge Rob on the podcast this week.
Hi, ladies.
Hi, Rob.
And gentlemen out there in listener land, I guess.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on again.
Mm-hmm. Anytime.
So we last heard from you when you joined us as our partner in Team Sealed in GP Portland.
It's true. Had a ton of fun in Portland. It was a great weekend. We signed off on Saturday night with me about to go out on Friday or on Sunday morning and, you know, fight with my commons and uncommons from M15 deck.
That's right.
That was so crazy.
And by the way, we have so many listeners who are waiting to know how that deck did.
So wait, what did you do precisely?
So it was a red blue artifacts and Shrapnel Blast plus and Soul artifact deck. That
you made exclusively from cards you opened at the sealed event.
Yes, I went diving through, between cards that the three of us opened in different limiteds and diving through some random commons and then bumming a couple cards off people. My only rare was Chandra Pyromaster, who I opened in one of my drafts.
And I guess two
Shivan Reefs as well.
So you made a deck for
yes.
four constructed and you
yes.
played it.
In the Super Sunday Series standard.
Did this deck or did it not have bronze sables in it?
It in fact had three bronze sables
amazing.
In it.
Amazing, mm-hmm. amazing.
I would have liked them to be Phyrexian Delvers, but those
you know
are
what?
Rares.
You didn't open those.
Yeah.
So how did this deck do?
It did. So I thought it was going to do awesome because round one I beat my opponent. He failed to do math for an onboard lethal and then conceded to me. And I was like, oh, you sure. Yeah, good games. but then in round two, I played Shuhei Nakamura.
That's a good player.
It was pretty rough.
Yes.
In game one, he cast three Sphinx's Revelations. And it turns out that card is better than my whole library.
Yeah, no. And you had an Insole Artifact.
It's actually true. I played an Insole Artifact, and then he Azorius Charmed it.
So sad.
Yeah, it was pretty rough.
So sad. To be fair, blue-white sounds like a terrible matchup for that deck.
Yes. It was like, they have every single card they could ever need to beat me.
Yeah, potentially the worst matchup for your deck.
Yes. And so I ended up going 1-3 drop. But I had a lot of fun and I trolled a lot of people and I actually won like a game, a match.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it was
pretty sweet.
Yeah. It wasn't entirely terrible. I was really wishing for Phyrexian and Delvers to be my two drop artifact guys, because then I could like turn off Jace, which would have been sweet.
Yeah,
I turn off Jace every night.
What does that mean?
It's just not into me.
Okay,
it's fair.
Okay, well, congratulations on your achievement of just making the craziest deck ever.
Yes.
And going full bore with it.
Yep. I was tired of limited.
Yeah.
And then I played limited at the end of the day and got trashed, and I remembered why I was tired of limited.
Yeah. Well, M15, guys.
M15, am I right?
Fuck that format.
Wait. Okay, sidebar on M15.
Yeah.
So when I'm bored, I draft. I mean, even when I'm not bored, I draft. I do it a lot online. And the last 5 M15 events, I either have won them or gotten second in 8-4s.
And Maria, why is that?
That is because I will build a deck specifically for triplicate spirits. Yes. Even if I do not open one, even if I do not see it, pack one or pack two, I will wait for it to come to me, because I think in most drafts, you'll at least see one triplicate spirits, right?
It is a common.
Right. So I build a deck specifically for triplicate spirits, and then if I get one, I get one. And if I don't, well, whatever, then I'll get second.
So you're forcing triplicate spirits.
Every time.
That's probably a fair choice.
I mean, as we can see, it works.
It's really... It works. At first, it was a joke. I was like, I wonder if this would actually work. And then it did.
I think there's only one uncommon as good as triplicate spirits, and that's Cone of Flame.
Right.
Like, yeah. Those are the two best uncommons by some absurd margin.
Question. What do you like better? I know we're on cons now, but just a quick question. Spirit Bonds or Cone of Flame?
Spirit Bonds is the rare that makes token spirits?
Yes.
Yes.
Cone of Flame.
Megan.
Triplicate spirits.
Okay. Anyway, cons of Tarkir, you guys, just pre-released this past weekend. It was great fun. Great fun playing this set. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I had a great time.
We're going to talk through some of the rules, though, because there are some tricky interactions. There's also some very easy interactions. So, quickly, we'll just mention... some of the mechanics. We went over them very briefly last week. Raid is straightforward, I think. That's the red mechanic. When you attack with something this turn, you get some kind of weird bonus.
Yep.
I don't see how that can possibly go wrong. I mean, maybe I'm forgetting something, but it seems very easy.
Nope. Yep. And all the cards with raid, you can only play at sorcery speed.
Right.
So you just only play them during your second main phase.
Yep.
So you can't get the raid bonus during combat.
Yeah, there you go. Simple.
Sweet.
So, really easy.
So, prowess, also very, very straightforward. If you cast a non-creature spell, you get the prowess bonus. If you don't, you don't.
One thing that if you're playing in competitive tournaments, you do want to note is that your opponent doesn't necessarily have to spell out that they're triggering prowess until the time that it's relevant. So if they have Jeskai Elder, and they cast a spell pre-combat, attack with the Jeskai Elder, you say damage, how much? And they say 2. Well, Jeskai Elder is normally a 1/1. And you go, well, why is it 2? And they go, well, I had a prowess trigger. You don't have to point out triggers until either you have to choose a target for them or the time is relevant for them to have an impact on the game, basically.
Right, so it's not required.
Yep.
Nice. That's different than with, like, counters, right? If you have, like, a trigger that puts a +1/+1 counter on something, you have to remember that at the time.
Right, because it produces a visual impact on the game is the lingo that we use as judges.
Oh, okay.
A counter is a visual change.
Yeah.
Putting a counter on, so they have to note it at that point.
Sweet. Oh, I didn't know that. I mean, so hold up. I have to announce my triggers most of the time. Just not all of the time?
So you should announce your triggers at the time that it chooses a target, which is when it goes in the stack if it targets. It produces a visual impact on the game when it does that thing, or at the time that it is relevant, if it does something that isn't a visual impact or doesn't target. So... if you remember from Innistrad, there was Heart Render Wolf, the one that says that when you attack with this, creatures you control must be blocked by 2 or more creatures. You only have to announce that when it's relevant, which is at the time that blockers are declared.
So this is prowess in the case falls in the class of when it's relevant.
Yep, which is when damage is being calculated usually.
Fabulous.
Or nice. If a spell is trying to kill your creature.
So remember, don't let anybody be a jerk to you. If they're like, oh, but you didn't announce it, you can be like, it's only relevant now.
Yep.
And they're like, well, it was relevant to me before I decided not to bounce it.
Yep.
And you're like, that sounds like
too bad.
Sounds like your problem.
Yeah. It sounds like you should ask me about that. Did your power sticker resolve? Oh, yes, it did, in fact, resolve. Okay, great. Then I should bounce your guy.
I want Megan to have a shirt that says, sounds like that's your problem.
I would wear that shirt 100%. 100% of the time.
So Ferocious is also fairly straightforward. This is the teamer mechanic. And did you have something with power four or greater? Well, then you get the bonus. The question that I heard come up at my pre-release was, when does it check to see if you have a creature with power four or greater?
Ferocious is interesting in that it's a little different on every card. It applies a bonus if you have a creature of power four or greater, but those can happen at different times. So for instance, there's Heir to the Wild. He's a 2/2 creature with death touch for green and one. And when Heir to the Wild attacks, or whenever Heir to the Wild attacks, if you have a creature with power four or greater, he gets +1/+1 until end of turn. And so his trigger checks both at the time that he attacks and again as it resolves, because it is an intervening if trigger. And so you have to look at the prowess or at the ferocious card and figure out what it's doing and how.
So can I say, if you're attacking, say, with him and a 4/4, and in declare attacks, you know, you get the +3/+3 because you attacked with both of them. And then your opponent, say, bounces your 4/4. Does he still have the +1/+1?
Well, it depends on when they bounce it.
If they declare attackers.
Well, they can respond to the trigger, right?
Oh, so it'll trigger.
Yes, he's a triggered ability. He says whenever.
Okay.
Whenever this attacks, if you control a creature with power 4 or greater. So it's a triggered ability, just like other triggered abilities. Some kinds of triggers are special. When this time happens, if this thing is true. And they have to be phrased exactly like that. And they're called triggers with an intervening if clause. Basically, they both check.
This one in grammar school.
Yeah.
That's a great name, though.
Yeah. So intervening if triggers check both at the time the trigger goes in the stack and the time the trigger resolves to see whether or not they're true. Heir to the Wild checks both at the time that his trigger condition is met, which is at the beginning of the attack step when he attacks, or begin to declare attackers when he attacks. And also, he checks again when the trigger resolves to see if it's true, to see if it still gets to happen.
That's crazy.
And like I said, every ferocious card is a little different. So if you look at, say, a spell with ferocious, like Savage Punch, which is super sweet. Savage Punch is green and one sorcery. Target creature you control fights target creature you don't control. Ferocious, the creature you control gets +2/+2 until end of turn before it fights if you control a creature with power 4 or greater. That checks as the spell is starting to resolve. Do you have ferocious? And if so, it changes the way that the spell resolves.
Okay. Question. If you have a creature like a 3, like a 3 something power creature. If you have a 3 power creature with prowess and you cast Savage Punch, are you going to get ferocious?
Yes, you will. Because you cast the ferocious spell. The prowess trigger goes in the stack above your spell.
Okay.
Prowess trigger resolves, and then your ferocious spell resolves.
Sweet.
Dragonstyle Twins is really good, because it's a 3/3 that has prowess, and also double strike.
And also the weirdest name of a card ever.
Yes.
Dragonstyle Twins? Like, what is that?
I think it's twins who are martial artists who fight in the style of a dragon.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was the Minnesota baseball team. The twins, who instead of, you know, their mascot, which is a
twin,
it's a man with a baseball on his head.
A baseball head. It is now a pair of fraternal twins
who are also dragons.
Who are also dragons.
I actually might go to baseball games if that.
I would be much more interested if that happened.
I don't know if you, can you tell the difference between fraternal dragon twins and
identical dragon
identical dragon twins?
I mean, I hate to sound racist, but I can't tell the difference between any two dragons. All dragons look the same to me.
Super racist, Megan.
I know.
Super racist.
I want to make the case that they're making a reference to video games.
What? Where they are?
Double Dragon. It's about two guys that fight on streets with dragon-style fighting. And they're twins.
What is dragon-style fighting? You breathe fire on them?
It's just a particular set of stances in combat. Like, they're dudes that fight... that are twins that are named Dragon. Like, that's the game, Double Dragon, is you wander around and fight.
Okay, this card definitely sounds like a reference to that.
Yeah, it does.
It's like, straight up.
When are they going to make a card on Paperboy? That's my real question.
When are they going to make a card based on Miss Pac-Man?
When are they going to make a Super Mario Sunshine card?
Its name would be Ghost Chomper.
Ghost Chomper? They had such a chance in Innistrad.
I know.
That's a horror movie. Ghost Chomper.
You guys, Ghost Chomper. Oh, well. I'm just saying, it looks like they have a bunch of, like, they have, like, knives in each hand that are kind of claw-shaped. And they're very, you know, like, reach out and stab you. Reach out and stab you.
So my initial question of attacking with the 2/2, who gets the 1/1 bonus if you have Ferocious?
Yep.
Upon declare attackers, the 4/4 that I'm also attacking with is bounced. So therefore, the +1/+1 bonus would not happen.
Correct. Yep. If you responded to the trigger, you can stop them from.
Okay, got it.
And that's, I think, the best time to do it because they've already committed to their attack.
Right.
And now they thought they had a 3/3, and it turns out they have a 2/2, and you can trade a morph for it.
Yep.
Which you couldn't before.
Nice. Okay. Well, that makes sense. That's kind of, you know, a ferocious kind of like a little sandwich, and inside you can mess with it if you can take out the meat.
I don't think that made a lot of sense.
It made perfect sense to me. What listener, raise your hand if that also made sense to you.
Because you're messing with a sandwich.
Because you're checking on both sides, and each side is like the bread.
Oh, okay.
For intervening if triggers, that's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you can take out something in the middle of the sandwich, and all of a sudden the bottom bread is upset.
The bottom bread falls out. Because, like, you know what was holding it together? That mayo. It was a mayo sandwich.
It was a mayo sandwich. You sound like my sister.
Sick.
Who would make pickle and mayonnaise sandwiches.
No. No. No.
Inhuman. All right. So those are some of our easier mechanics. How about Delve? That's a little trickier. Delve.
So, yep. Delve changes the way that you can cast your spells, basically. It changes the way that you pay. And there was a really subtle change to Delve about a year ago with the release of Magic 2014 that also changed Convoke. And for Convoke, it mostly doesn't matter, but for Delve, it matters a lot. Delve used to be something that you would determine while you were determining how you cast the spell early on. And it like super technical stuff, but what it boils down to is you used to be able to over-delve. You used to be able to delve for more cards than the colorless cost of your spell.
Oh, so you could save it?
Well, not save it. Let's say that you were casting Treasure Cruise, which is blue and 7, right? You used to be able to delve and remove like 9 cards from your graveyard.
And it would still only pay for 7 colorless, how many there are.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so this seems like it might be entirely irrelevant. You'd say, why would I ever want to pay, you know, more for my spell? But when you're paying cards from your graveyard, it's relevant because there are cards that care about the cards that are in your graveyard. Like Tarmogoyf is the classic one. So you could overdelve in order to remove your whole graveyard for a Tombstalker, and then their Tarmogoyf would be substantially decreased in size.
Yeah.
You can't do that anymore. It's relevant with a card in Cons, actually, Keru Lichlord.
Right.
He's a zombie wizard, 4/4 for blue, green, black, and 3. At the beginning of your upkeep, you may pay black and 2. If you do, return a creature card at random from your graveyard to the battlefield. It gains flying, trample, and haste. Exile that card at the beginning of your next end step. If it would leave the battlefield, exile it instead of putting it anywhere else. And so if you have, say, 15 creature cards in your graveyard and a Treasure Cruise, and you want to delve and remove all but the best 3 for your Keru Lichlord.
Oh, so he's better.
Yeah, so you're not returning a random creature that includes, like, Harbinger of Spring or, you know, any of these guys that is just terrible to try to attack with with haste. You can't remove more than the number of colorless mana symbols on the card anymore.
I played against an opponent who played this card yesterday.
Carol Lichlord?
That Lichlord, yeah.
How was it?
Turns out it is a good card.
Oh, I opened one of those suckers yesterday.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. Not unbeatable because I beat it. But pretty good nonetheless. Yeah.
He's a fine guy. He rewards you for the Sultai Self-Mill deck, which is very powerful. That's what I played yesterday in the pre-release, and I found out, first of all, that I misbuilt my deck. Like, round 3, I had to completely rebuild my deck and, you know, add in white and play 4 colors, because my Sultai cards weren't quite good enough on their own, but he was the king. If he survived for, like, a turn or two after I cast him, then he just won the game, because I played all of these morph guys with, like, 6 power.
Yeah,
sweet.
Would just, like, make a 6-power flying haste guy.
Go.
Yeah,
yep.
Getcha.
Deal with it. All right, so what other tricky stuff might happen with Delve?
With Delve, note that the converted mana cost of the spell doesn't change. Converted mana cost is never going to change anyways. But there is, what is the name of the card? It's in this set. It counters target spell with converted mana cost 4 or greater.
Oh, yeah. It's like...
That's that blue one?
Yep.
That blue counterspell, yes.
The one that's like...
No, it's the red counterspell. Don't you remember?
Slap you down.
It's like... Yeah. It's like disdainful stroke. Like,
yeah, there you go. Disdainful stroke.
Is that it for sure?
Yes. Yes. Counter target spell with converted mana cost.
You guys, how did I get there?
I have no idea. But so disdainful stroke, counter target spell with converted mana cost 4 or greater. Delve doesn't change the converted mana cost. Okay. It just lets you pay for that cost via cards in your graveyard instead of mana.
Sure, makes
and
sense.
And so you can still counter their treasure cruise with a disdainful stroke, no matter if they're only paying single blue
so
for
sweet.
It.
Yeah.
It'd be pretty good. They burn all their resources and then they try to insist a recall and you just say, nope.
Nope.
Note, I love Treasure Cruise. That card is amazing.
It is pretty great. I also love the art on it.
Yes. The art is sweet.
That would be a sweet playmat. You guys, I love playmats.
You have a problem.
I know.
So, that's Delve. Now we come...
Wait, I have one more Delve question.
Oh, okay. Ask it.
Sure. So, in response to someone casting a Delve spell, mm-hmm. Say I have Cranial Archive. I can activate that and... how am I trying to say this? Can I exile their graveyard in response to some card being on the stack?
So just like you can't tap their lands in response to them trying to tap them for mana to try to prevent them from casting a spell, you can't prevent them from moving cards for Delve. They're doing it as part of the cost of casting the spell, which is before you get the chance to respond to it.
Yeah. So like if that spell is on the stack, they've already paid for it.
Yep.
In which case they've already dealt those cards.
Okay. Got it. Check and mate.
So, now we go move on to the Big Daddy Rules Master. Morph.
Morph.
Yeah.
This is in, I would say, the top three most complicated block mechanics ever made.
Really? We know that banding is number one.
Banding wasn't a block mechanic. Banding was evergreen. Phasing was a block mechanic, though. Phasing is dumb. I have many problems with phasing. One of which is, if you go and look at phasing cards, zero phasing cards have reminder text. They'll put reminder text for Island Walk on a phasing card, but not for phasing.
What the heck is phasing?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
Okay, phasing is, at the beginning of your untap step, everything you have that is phased out phases in, and everything you have that wasn't phased out with phasing phases out.
I quit. I'm not playing.
Yeah. Basically, things flicker themselves.
Okay.
But they keep their counters and their auras and their stuff.
All right, what's number two?
Number two is actually probably Morph. Morph's probably the second most complicated.
Number three?
Third most complicated is one that is complicated not because it's got a bunch of rule stuff, but because it screws with your ability to...
With your mind.
Yeah, screws with your mind. And I would say that's Threshold in Odyssey. Because Threshold made it so that it would be the right play to discard your whole hand of spells to an effect that you didn't care about.
That's weird.
Yeah, there'd be like a 1/1 with discard a card to gain first strike, and you'd be like, okay, the right play here is to discard my hand.
That's insane.
Well, because Odyssey was all about reverse card advantage and making like cards count. It didn't count the same,
and so
because Threshold existed, having 7 cards in your graveyard is oftentimes more important than having any cards at all in your hand.
That sounds like. Let's not talk.
Yeah, it was weird.
What we're trying to say is Morph is complicated.
Yeah, Morph changes the rules for how you can cast spells. It says if you have a spell with Morph in your hand, you can turn it face down before you even cast it and move it to the stack face down, so your opponent never gets to see it. And while something is face down, the rules define it as a 2/2 colorless creature.
With no converted mana cost.
Yeah, I just listed all the characteristics. Anything else that you might ask about the card, you get a nope.
Okay.
What's its creature type? Nope.
Does it have a soul?
Nope.
Okay.
Sad.
And so it's a 2/2 colorless creature, and you can only do this with cards that have the Morph ability. On the battlefield, Morph is a special effect that applies to that card. There are not a lot of these. One of these is Bestow, actually, is a special effect that's applying to that card. It's a continuous effect, and you can end this by taking the special action of turning it face up, revealing the morph cost to your opponent, and paying the morph cost. And so, because it's a special action, it's like playing a land. Playing a land is a special action as well. Doesn't use the stack, can't be responded to.
It's a special action.
It's
That's
true.
So weird. So I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. That did they just invent that? Can wizards just say, guess what?
Yep.
We're putting something in the set that you can't... Nope, new
it's
thing.
It's called a special action.
So, new thing.
Yep, the big deal is the reason that turning it face up should be a special action and that you can't respond to it is it would be really terrible for...
Yes, it would.
Me to turn my guy face up and be like, I've got a morph. And you go, that's fine, Magma Jet.
Yeah, that sucks.
And I go, oh, well, I guess I don't have a morph. And I guess I paid mana to turn it face up because it was an activated ability. And so I had to pay the cost. So I just paid 7 mana to turn my 6/7 elephant face up, and you countered it with a Magma Jet. That's pretty terrible.
Yeah, I'm glad Wizards did that, because that would be horribly unfun.
Yeah, and so the big deal with morph is, so turning it face up, you can't respond to, but there are some morphs that have when this gets turned face up triggers. Ponyback Riders.
Ponyback Brigade.
Ponyback Brigade, sorry.
Ponyback Brigade.
They are super sweet. They say, when this enters the battlefield or is turned face up, put 3/1/1 red goblin tokens onto the battlefield. And so they have a when this is turned face up trigger. There are also a very small number of morphs that have a as you turn this face up, do something trigger. That's not a trigger. As you turn this face up. It replaces turning face up with turning face up in a different way. Just like clone changes entering the battlefield to entering the battlefield differently.
Whoa, I didn't know that there's a difference as this turns face up.
So triggered abilities say when, whenever, and at, right? They're triggers. They can go on the stack. You can respond to them, right?
Yeah.
There are some things that you don't want to work that way. Say, Vesuvian Shapeshifter, which is as this turns face up, you can have it copy something.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense.
And if it was a trigger, then it would go on the stack, but it would be a 0/0 with a triggered ability on the stack, and it would die.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is not what you want out of life.
Rules!
Yep. And so there's one in this set. Let me check. I don't remember what it is now, but let me check out.
Isn't it? It's Clever Impersonator.
Oh, Clever Impersonator. Yep. As it gets turned face up, you can copy something. And so Clever Impersonator has the same, surprise. It turns out to be this all along.
No, he's on morph. He's just an enter. But he's a 0/0 enter.
So it's
He's similar to clones in that he has entered the battlefield.
Oh,
Hooded Hydra. Hooded Hydra is the part that I'm thinking of. As it's turned face up, put 5+1/+1 counters on it.
Okay.
Yes.
Because it wants to be a Hydra with +1/+1 counters.
Sure.
Yes.
So Hooded Hydra has, as Hooded Hydra's turned face up, put 5+1/+1 counters on it. There's no time when it's face up that it won't have 5 counters on it.
Okay.
And so just remember that there's no time that it's a 0/0. It'll just always have the counters.
Right.
Nice.
And that also sets up its trigger, which is when Hooded Hydra dies, put a 1/1 green snake creature token to the battlefield for each +1/+1 counter on it. So there'll be no time that it's face up that it won't have counters in order to make some snake tokens.
Word. So question.
Yep.
Oh, wait, I forgot it. Let's keep moving. Okay.
Maybe you should have another Pop-Tart, Megan.
Oh. Watch out or I will.
Let's actually talk about Clever Impersonator with Morph a little bit, because he's the clone in the set.
Sure.
Yeah.
If you copy something that is face down, your copy will be a 2/2, and it will be a creature, and it will be nothing else, just like Morph's.
It will have no soul, just like Morph's.
No name, no mana cost, no creature types.
Sad.
Yep. No abilities, no flavor text. And... so Clever Impersonator can copy morphs for not a lot of value. Morph lets you do some strange things. Do you know the card Polymorphous Jest?
Yes. That turns everything into frogs. It was my cutest card from M15.
It's true. And it
Never
removes abilities too, correct?
Never figured it's cutest card.
So the trick with morph is being face down is a status that overwrites the card, but the card is still there underneath it. So Polymorphous Jest, if you Polymorphous Jest and they have a face down creature, they can't turn it face up. Because if they go, all right, I want to turn this face up and show you the morph cost, they go turn it face up and it doesn't have any abilities, which includes morph. And so they can't turn things face up that have been Polymorphous Jested.
Whoa.
That's crazy.
Whoa.
It's super weird.
But they could do it in response.
Yeah, they could do it in response. But if they let your Polymorphous Jest resolve on their guy, well, then... they have a frog on the other side, too. So it's a 1/1 on the...
Whoa!
That is magic! We're playing magic, and that is literal magic.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes. Similarly, if you use Polymorphous Rush from Theros,
yeah,
the Polymorphous Rush says any number of target creatures become copies of things.
Right.
You can, if you have a face down creature, you can make it a copy of something else, and being face down overwrites being a copy because of how the rules work. So it's still like you could use Polymorphous Rush to turn your face, try to turn your face down creature into a copy of, say, a Woolly Loxodon, okay, who's a different morph creature. But it'll still be a 2/2 with no name or types because morph overwrites the base qualities of the card.
So you can't even copy it.
Well, here's the trick. Now you can turn it face up and say, surprise, I'm a Woolly Loxodon. Because the because the front face is a copy of Woolly Loxodon that is turned face down.
I'm glad this is Megan looks like you're
why?
This, look, we never are gonna have to worry about this unless some jank holes start playing this in standard.
That's true.
It's true.
That's true.
I'm picking standard cards specifically because it's something that could in theory come up at an FNM if somebody wants to troll you.
Now I am going to go troll other people.
with my
Polymorphous Rush, Polymorphous Jest, and Woolly Loxodon deck.
Yes. it's more relevant with other morphs that do relevant things, like say Hooded Hydra. You have a crappy morph face down with like a bad body.
Mm-hmm.
You turn it into a copy of Hooded Hydra and go to turn it face up.
Judge Rob, we try not to body shame cards here.
Well, I'm sorry, but if you have a 1/1, you deserve what you get.
I understand. I understand what you're saying. Okay.
And so you have a Hooded Hydra that's face up. You use Polymorphous Rush to turn your random 1/1 that is currently face down, like, what's his name? The 1/1 that regenerates that everybody hates so much.
Oh, yeah. He's green.
Yeah.
Who cares?
But you could turn it into a copy of Hooded Hydra, then turn it face up and get 5 +1/+1 counters on it, because it is a Hooded Hydra right now.
Oh, snap.
Cool.
And then when that Polymorphous Jest goes away, that card just has 5 +1/+1 counters on it.
Yes, because those don't go away.
All right.
Nice.
I'm in.
Nice.
I'm playing this deck.
Well, you probably wouldn't. This seems like the worst use of 8 mana that you could spend.
I feel like I want to embarrass myself at an FNM. That's what I want to do.
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, great.
But, so, yeah, Morph lets you do some strange things. It's a real judge tinkery kind of rules question thing that 99% of people don't care about. They say, oh, I can turn my guy face up and I do it. Like,
yeah,
there's
nothing I can do about it. So
yeah,
there you
yeah,
go.
The straightforward thing to remember is you can't stop your opponent from turning stuff face up. And then it'll trigger some when this turns face up. Like Ice Feather Aven is a when this gets turned face up, return another target creature to its owner's hand. Well, that trigger's going to go on the stack.
Nice, no matter what.
Yeah, you can still respond to it. You could, you know, give your creature hexproof or, you know, turn up your own creature and turns out that it has hexproof or whatever, because there's a couple of those.
Right.
But the big deal is that the turning face up component is not an activated ability. You can't prevent it with Phyrexian Devourer or Phyrexian
Revoker,
yeah. The other thing to note is face downs, like we mentioned, have no names. And so because they have no names, they don't share a name with anything. So cards that say destroy target creature and everything that has the same name as it, well, they don't do anything to morphs.
Okay. Like,
because they
just plain old have no name.
Yep. And so it
talk about a morph with rode into town on a morph with no name, am I right?
What a great movie that was.
In a town on a morph with no name. It is a 2/2, but nothing's the same as the other types of creatures on my board.
I mean, I was waiting to see how long you can keep going with that. Quite a bit longer than I was expecting.
Yep. So, like, Morph is the most complicated under the hood, but in 99% of gameplay, it's just turn guys up, turns out they were something else, pay their Morph cost.
Nice.
And it's super nice in a multicolored set because it is mana fixing, just straight up. They've got a cycle of common guys that cost all 3 colors of mana, and they're all very powerful, but, like, sometimes you don't have all 3 colors of mana, and you need to be able to just make your guy gray over.
Tell me about it.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the pre-release, but I'm just going to say this note right now. I believe, after having played with morphs, that any card that says morph on it is a good card.
I also believe that when my opponent has played a face-down morph card, that that card is a 5/5 flyer that also has an act of treason, you know, stuck onto it. Because that is my worst nightmare. So in my head, yeah, that's what every face-down card says.
Yeah, they're scary. They're scary. That's true.
Yep. That's a pretty fair assessment. That when in doubt, treat your opponent's morph creature is the very worst thing that could happen to you.
Yes. Right? Like, what's the worst thing that could happen? That's what that card is.
Actually, I feel like, so, I don't know, I felt like what the times I played as if my opponent's morph card was going to absolutely destroy me, those were the games that did not do well. And the games when I played as if I was fine with my opponent's morph creature, whatever it happened to be, were the games I did better.
I just killed them. I just killed them all.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, when I played too scared around that morph card, I think that was a mistake.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's all.
I just mean that every time I had an opportunity to kill a morph, I pretty much did it.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
Yeah, I think that's pretty right, because the thing that they did in cons that they didn't do an onslaught. In cons, there are very few morphs that don't cost a lot of mana to turn face up that are also large on the other side, or that can fight a morph successfully. Like, you have to pay like five plus mana in order to kill a morph with your morph. Where in onslaught, they had basically the worst case scenario, which is if they attack with a morph with mana up and they have three red mana up, you had to decide block with my morph or not. And if you were wrong and it was Battering Craghorn, well, that's a 3/1 first striker that flips up for three. And if you were wrong and it was Skirt Commando, that's a 1/1 red creature that whenever it deals combat damage to a player, deals 2 damage to a creature that turns face up for 3. And so if you guessed wrong, like, they just got you.
That sucks. I'm glad they didn't do that.
That's just like 100% guess scenario when they've played it. You're just like, well, crap. Well, let's see.
You know, it was really spiky. They wanted people to feel good about bluffing and, you know, faking out their opponent, making good guesses. But it was just a straight up, like...
coin flip.
Yeah, coin flip. Do you think your opponent's going to block? Attack with your Battering Craghorn. They didn't block. Don't turn your face up. They go, can't be a Skirt Commando. And it turns out you were just faking them out because it is a Skirt Commando.
So... the ability that I have, which is the ability to read minds, would have come in handy in onslaught block.
Yes, reading minds is super handy against morph.
Megan, you did not even flinch when I mentioned that I have the ability to read minds. You did not even question.
Well, I can also read minds, so I already knew that you could read minds.
Oh.
I feel left out, because I can't read minds at all.
It's okay. It comes with time.
Fair.
So cons pre-release, we all had a ton of fun. I'm just going to speak for the group.
Yeah.
Is that true? Yes, yes.
I had a blast.
Yes, I had a great time.
Overall thoughts on cons. I thought it was very, very fun, very deep, complex, and interesting.
I would agree with all of those things.
All those adjectives.
Yes. Despite the fact that Morph had me terrified all the time.
Yeah.
It was very exciting.
Do you have any adjectives to add to this list, Rob?
I would say that it was difficult. The build process was very hard.
Yeah, that's true.
I would say that this is probably even harder than Return to Ravnica, which is the hardest most difficult recent set to build. The
mana base was challenging.
Yep.
Challenging to build mana base.
And knowing that you could... Well, the other thing with the mana base is I opened like 9 different lands that tap for multiple colors of mana, and figuring out that I could play a fourth color and not hurt myself too much. Like, I was like, I only want to play 3 colors. 4th colors is always terrible, right? Well, turns out that 4 colors was the right build for myself.
Well, think about this. Yeah. Like, Megan and I, this is our first time pretty much playing 3 color decks. And yesterday I played 4 color decks.
Exactly.
And it's just like, what? You know? This is not a thing in my life I'm used to having.
Not at all.
Like, when I get teeth, I'm sure it'll be a really different experience for me. Similarly. You know, chewing hard food for the first time. What's that like? I don't know.
It'll be very interesting, for sure.
Yeah. So, clans, as everybody might have guessed, I chose Mardu. And as I was walking up to choose my clan, I was, like, still trying to decide if I should do Abzan, because everyone's totally in love with Abzan. Because for a good reason, it's got some sweet cards. And I was nervous that Mardu was going to be too weak and too fast and fizzle versus an Abzan fat fatties deck, right? But I went with my heart and I chose Mardu. And I made a pretty awesome sweet deck that had relatively little trouble winning. And I think that it all was on the back of one of my favorite cards that I played with, a Ponyback Brigade. Oh, Ponyback. I had 2 Ponyback Brigades. Excellent. Excellent card.
Were you also playing a number of trumpet blast style effects?
Not even. I did not have any.
What's the name? Battle... Russia Battle?
Is that the really yeah, Russia one? Battle.
Mm-hmm. Russia Battle blew me out with Ponyback Brigade.
Oh yeah, I bet it would. It would have been great to have, but turns out just having 3-1 ones, in addition to me flooding the board with other small crap, was fine.
Yeah.
And then backing it up with stuff like red, I mean, Mardu has some sweet removal. It has access to Killshot, of which I had 2. It had access to Smite the Monstrous, which I had 1. And I my promo is Crackling Doom, which makes them sacrifice their biggest dude, which was awesome when I made somebody sacrifice their 6-6 teamer con. When they like played, they flashed him in and were like, I'm going to block you. And I'm like, oh, are you though? Or are you going to just murder your own con? I think you're going to murder your own con. Okay. And also the red that it deals 4 damage or 5 if you have raid. That I used as a lava axe many times.
Yeah.
You know,
there's
fine.
Also, what's his name? The raid that deals 2 damage? The 2-3 for 4?
Yeah, the heart piercer. I finished somebody off with that. Yep. Great card. Great card. I killed Megan's... We're practicing in a practice round. I killed your 4-2 bear with that card.
That was so sad.
Pretty good.
That bear.
Also, we'll kill a morph, which I think is insane.
It's very, very relevant. Yeah.
So... anyway, Mardu performed admirably for me and was great. I also like the 2-3 Kirin flyer.
Oh, the Alabaster Kirin.
Yeah, the little flying horse or whatever the heck a Kirin is.
It's like an
Kirins
antelope.
Are spirit horses.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, well, Kirins have existed in magic before. It isn't new type.
It's a spirit of a horse?
It's a horse that is a spirit, I think.
What? But it's got these big old horn things on it.
Yeah, it's...
Well, you know, maybe it's a weird... You know, maybe it had a...
It's a horned horse. Okay, problem solved.
Like a
it has a slightly different... the previous Kirins were all in Kamigawa, and they were legendary creatures that rewarded you for playing spirits and arcane spells, just every other card in that block.
Sure.
and so that this is the first outside of Kamigawa Kirin we've ever gotten.
Nice.
So yeah, I was happy to know that Mardu is a thing, and it can survive going up against enormous dudes. And
so, although I have to note, I think at our store, Mardu was the most popular. They ran out of first.
It was. Yeah, a lot of stores, I think Obzon went first. I don't know, and Mardu was like second or something, but...
And that surprises me, considering how much people have complained about Outlast. Like, we didn't talk really about Outlast
as
a rules thing, because Outlast tells you what it does in the card.
It's pretty easy.
I guess the one thing that I do have to remind people, I did have to remind people about a couple times, is that you can't Outlast on your opponent's turn.
Sorcery.
It's only as a sorcery.
Yep.
And this is specifically because when they designed it, it was called Hunker Down, and it was instead of attacking, you get to outlast, or you get to hunker down.
Yeah.
And so it made sense to only use it on your turn.
I'm really glad that they renamed that.
Hunker Down. That sounds so dumb.
And so, it's meant to be a trade-off. Instead of attacking, you do this.
Right. Yeah.
And I think it's actually really powerful because almost all the Outlast guys give a bonus to creatures with +1/+1 counters on them.
Yeah, I played Abzan yesterday, and I had first of all the Ivory Tusk Fortress, which lets you untap guys with +1/+1 counters.
So good.
So then you're like outlasting for free. Like you didn't get to attack, sure, but I also get to block with those dudes. And I had the guy who gives Death Touch and the one that gives Flying. And the one that gives Trample.
You also had a Wingmate Rock.
That's true.
Did you cast him?
That was so sweet. God, yes, I cast that card.
So good.
Card is so good. But anyways, it was pretty sweet, especially the one that gave Flying.
Yes.
There were times when it was just like, that was how I ended up killing my opponent, because it's like, I went from having 1 flyer to having 4 flyers.
Yeah, so 4 flyer. Awesome.
Well, and this set isn't terribly thick with flyers either, it doesn't feel like.
Mm-mm.
It felt like Flying was just very, very good.
Yeah. I mean, green has a lot of options to be able to get reach.
Yes.
But other than that, I don't know.
I mean, there's the Prowess flyer in blue. There's, I think there's a White Morph flyer.
There's like the 1/5 White Morph.
Yep. And I mean, there's a Blue Morph flyer that has Defender. It's
yep,
like an 0/5 flying
0/5.
Defender. Yeah.
Yep. Monastery Flock. There's also the 2/1 White Morph flyer.
Okay.
Watcher of the Roost.
Watcher of the Roost.
Got it.
So, but like you said, not a ton of flyers. So sometimes it was just like, especially like you put a counter on that Ivory Tusk Fortress somehow, and it's like, here's my 6/8 flying elephant, you guys.
Yep.
Dumbo! You made a Dumbo!
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like the Simic had missed that opportunity, and now we get to make up for it.
Yes.
You guys, do you realize that was his deal, right? He could fly?
Yes.
Yeah, because he had giant ears.
That's what you made.
Okay.
Well, I'm so excited about this.
Why are you so excited about a movie from like the 1980s? That was honestly kind of creepy. I was creeped out by that movie.
Sure,
as
there were
a kid.
Lots of good but creepy movies from the 80s, though. Yeah. I mean, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off is pretty
what?
High in the creepy
How
scale.
Is it creepy?
How is that movie creepy?
Ferris is the largest asshole. Like, like he burns
not the
down
biggest
everyone
asshole,
else's lives.
The largest asshole. Yes. Yeah, it's true. Like, that kid, he smashed his dad's car. Like,
and they just yeah. celebrate. Like,
Ferris is pretty big dick.
Like, at the end of it, I was like, is this a role model? What should I... Like, there were no good characters. Everybody was a villain. Like...
That's... Okay, you're right.
Like, Charlie Sheen wanders on stage and seduces Ferris's sister. What the heck?
Oh, yeah, I remember that part. Yep, yep. Yeah.
Maybe we can just safely say all movies in the 80s had some creep factor to them.
Okay.
Yeah. Even Back to the Future. Marty makes out with his mom. Like, that's...
Weird.
That
yeah,
is weird.
No, that's creepy.
That is
yeah,
creepy
and weird. It's creepy and weird.
That is creepy. The Hug-A-Bunch. Anybody out there remember the Hug-A-Bunch? That was just straight up creepy. Not even anything redeemable about that movie. Do you know that movie?
No, I have no idea what you're talking
I'm gonna
about.
I'm going to show you. Look it up on YouTube. Find a clip. And I want you not to have a night terror the same night you watch that clip.
Okay.
Hug a bunch.
Sounds good.
Anyway, what were we talking about?
So we were talking about our pre-release.
Oh, right, right. So Megan, obs on, thumbs up.
Yeah, I really liked it. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I had a good time, you know, outlasting some stuff, putting some counters on things. Although, I have to say, my two like outstanding cards that I loved were not necessarily Abzan cards, because the first one was Debilitating Injury.
Great card.
One in a black enchantment, target creature gets -2/-2. I never used that to do anything less than kill something.
Kill a morph.
And yep. I often killed a morph with it.
Yep.
I ran two of them and I was just thrilled. That card is super sweet.
Super good.
Yeah. And then the other one was Seeker of the Way, which is one and a white for a 2/2 with prowess. And it also has, whenever you cast a non-creature spell, this creature gets lifelink. So I had a couple of Feet of Resistance, which is also an amazing card,
yes.
which is put a +1/+1 counter and it gains protection from a creature, or protection from a color. And... Or if I cast Debilitating Injury, it was just every time it was amazing. It was like I had a 3/3 and I killed your guy and my guy had lifelink in the meantime.
That's a lot to remember. I think prowess could be one of those things that I might forget. Like, it also had prowess.
But this card, the bonus is so good. I feel like you're never going to forget it because you're like, damn straight, I'm about to attack you with a 3/3 lifelink.
It's true.
Okay. What did you choose, Rob?
I traded. So the way that we do pre-releases at my store is we hand out everybody a random pack and then give them some time to trade, including trading with a pool of stuff from the store to get people to interact and talk and chat with each other. And then if anybody's super unhappy, we can usually get them fixed up with what they
Is this like want. The equivalent of sharing the peace?
Yeah, pretty close. Peace be with you.
At church, like you have to do that thing where you shake hands and stuff?
I obviously was not raised in a God-fearing household.
Well, it's a really, really Protestant thing.
Yeah, like super... Oh, boy.
But, so, like, we do all this trading and swapping, and because most of the time I don't care what I get, I just hold up my thing and trade with anybody who wanders by me.
So you're the constant trade, you somebody like 10 times, you're like, whatever.
Yeah, I traded 4 different things. I got handed a Sultai deck randomly, traded around it, ended up with a Sultai deck. And Sultai was actually really sweet. My single best card was probably the 3 copies of Scout the Borders that I had.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
What does Scout the Borders do?
It's green and 2 for a sorcery. Reveal the top 5 cards of your library. You may put a creature or land card from among them into your hand and put the rest into your graveyard.
Oh, nice.
So it just always puts 5 cards in your graveyard.
What, it costs how much?
3.
Oh,
green
that's
and 2.
Not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Basically, other people would cast morphs on 3 and I would scout the borders. Because the format is a little slower unless they're playing like unlimited Valley Dashers.
Yeah.
Which I had one guy cast 4 successive Valley Dashers against me and killed me.
Whoa.
Yeah. He was like...
He is really trying to get into that valley, if you know what I mean.
Yes, it's true.
Thanks.
Welcome.
And so Scout the Borders just always filled up my graveyard, which set me up for all of my dredge cards. I had like 6 or 7 dredge cards.
That many?
Yes. I had a dead drop, a treasure cruise, 2 of the 3/5s with Death Touch, and I didn't have the flyer, which was unfortunate.
I had that flyer. Oh, yeah, that card is sweet.
Awesome. Really good. And so Delve is, like, it's one of those mechanics that you can only put on so many cards in your library at once, and you also need to enable it. But Scout the Borders just set me up in situations where there was one game where I, late in the game, had, you know, 1-for-1 all of his cards with all of my removal. And it was like, all right, I need to pick up some cards here. So I'm going to cast Treasure Cruise, delve away 7 cards. Oh, I drew a dead drop. I still have 9 cards left.
How black. Was dead drop for?
Dead drop was really good. Really, really good.
That's what I heard in general.
I was wondering,
the only card in my deck that could beat a Ponyback Brigade.
Sure.
Because if they had a Ponyback Brigade, I needed to kill 3 guys in order to get back to parity. And dead drop solves 2 of those, and it was usually costing me about black and 1 or black and 2. But I delved 15 cards in 2 spells with a Treasure Cruise plus dead drop.
Did you cast Treasure Cruise for 1 blue yes. mana? It happened! I knew what's gonna happen!
I never cast it for more than blue and 1, actually. Because Scout the Borders puts 5 cards in your graveyard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I would Scout the Borders, and then I would Crippling Chill.
Sure.
And then I would have 6 cards, and I'd be like, sure, blue and 1 is fine to draw 3 cards.
Did you, on this treasure cruise, did you eat unlimited shrimp?
I actually didn't go for the shrimp. I went for the unlimited king crab.
Oh.
Fancy. Also good fancy
choice.
Man.
Good choice. Because my question with dead drop is, you know, am I going to... My question with this format, I think,
yeah.
was, am I always going to have 2 dudes that I care about, you know, you want me to sacrifice, or am I going to have dudes that I don't care about and it's fine to sacrifice?
You'll have disposable dudes, but the big deal, I think, is that there's a lot of blockers in this format. There's a lot of, like, O4s for single black and O3s for single blue, and, like, every color has this, like, humongous turtley thing for 3 mana or less, it feels like, except for red. And red still has some pretty solid blockers.
It does.
And so you end up in a situation where, like, you... The person who is trying to raid has like 2 more creatures than the other person or something, and dead drop just puts you back at parity all the time, or just crushes 2 of their guys so you can get not on attack.
Okay, alright.
And because like the last time that sacrifice 2 creatures was printed was Barter in Blood, which is each player sacrifices 2 creatures.
Cool.
But that cost 4 mana. That was black, black, and 2, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Dead
drop is asymmetrical, and I was finding that like we played 2 at a giant, I played teamer, and even in my teamer deck, I always had like 4 cards in my graveyard by the time I wanted to cast something like that.
Yeah.
The Mardu and Abzan decks don't cast as many spells into their graveyard, but there's like, you get to the point where you just traded guys or, you know.
Yeah. Or you like cast some of your own removal, yeah. like some other removal or some burn spells or something.
Yeah. Or what's the name of the Read the Bones equivalent in this set? It's the draw 2, or it's
Tormented
the look at the top
4. Thoughts.
Tormented Thoughts. Yeah. It's look at the top 4, put 2 in your hand and 2 in your graveyard.
I'm sorry.
Oh,
no.
Bitter
that's
Revelation.
Bitter Revelation. Yeah. Yep. And that's conditionally better than Read the Bones too. And Read the Bones is really good.
Mm-hmm.
But this lets you look at 4, pick the 2 that you like, put the other 2 in your graveyard, and then puts itself in the graveyard. Which, if that's the only mm-hmm. spell you've cast this game, that still puts your dead drop at black and 6, which isn't amazing, but it's still, like, it's getting there.
Yeah, no, it totally is.
You get there.
Nice.
And so there's a lot of space for interesting stuff going on in the Sultai.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see where Cons goes, how it develops as a young woman. Now I'm turning into a creepy 80s movie.
Who it's going to go to prom with?
Probably
whether
the next set.
Whether it's
going to
be its son.
I had a great time, and I'm excited to play some more release events in the future. Keep doing more stuff.
So Maria and I are about to go play another pre-release event.
Yep, yep.
Maria, what con do you think you're going to go?
What con?
Clan.
Oh, okay. Well, if I had a choice, I would probably just pick Mardu again because I didn't get to play with that demon, and that's the most thing that I want to open, that flying demon.
Butcher of the Horde?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But I think I'm not going to have a choice. I'm probably going to end up with Sultai. Hopefully not Jeskai. We'll see.
I'm kind of feeling like I want to try out Jeskai.
Okay.
Jeskai sounds kind of sweet.
All right. We'll see what happens. Yeah. We'll update you, listeners, next
podcast. I'll bounce some of your things with my blue, and I'll burn some of your things with red. Exile some of your things with white. Deal with it. So what's going on with GPs, you guys?
So Grand Prix, there was a really substantial change announced earlier this year. Judges will no longer be getting judge foils as part of working a Grand Prix.
Oh, man. So yes. What does that mean?
So functionally, what that means is that Wizards is no longer providing a draw for judges to come to Grand Prix. And organizers are going to take up that slack by increasing the compensation. But the money has to come from somewhere. We don't share our numbers publicly, but our margins on a Grand Prix are enough so that we can have basically one full-time employee and a part-time employee worth of time working on Grand Prix outside of the events.
And that makes sense.
If we just don't raise our prices and start compensating judges more, then what happens is we lose all of our margin. And if we ever get hit with an event like, say, Dallas-Fort Worth, which hit us last year, which had... we estimated for 1,400 players and only had 850 show up because there was an ice storm. We get wrecked. It was, Dallas-Fort Worth was not... We have to crunch a bunch of numbers to figure out exactly how badly it hurt us, but it was pretty terrible. And so we're raising the cost of Grand Prix across the board. Every organizer has announced Grand Prix cost hikes.
How much more is it going to be?
Because organizers can price it whatever they want. Different organizers have announced different things. Both of the post-foils GPs that have been announced for the US are at $60. And Cascade just increased Los Angeles, which is a with foils Grand Prix, to $50.
Sure. So are some people angry because they're saying, now Wizards just isn't giving judges anything? What's the deal with that?
So the problem with foils is that they shouldn't be compensation. They kind of morphed into compensation over time. They're intended to be a thank you to judges who are doing exemplary work in their areas. And those judges would happen to get invited to Grand Prix and happen to get foils. But the program is too big for that now. And so the foils were removed from Grand Prix and moved to a different program called Exemplar. Basically, judges get to recognize other judges, and the recognized judges may receive foils. There's been no promise of exactly where the mapping is for recognition to foils. That's in a test stage right now, where only level 3+ judges are providing recognition. But that's just for this year is in the test. Next year, level 2+ judges are going to get the chance to recognize judges, and then foils will be sent out. And it will be, from what we've been told, similar number of foils getting handed out to Grand Prix. So that is going to be a lot of foils that are getting mailed out by Wizards to judges.
Okay.
So they're trying to correct what was, yes, like where the program initially went wrong.
Yes.
I can understand that, where it's like, oh, you should be paying your judges, not being, yes, like, here's some foils.
Yes.
That's what you get.
Yep. And the thing was that functionally, players were subsidizing these events through card purchases. Basically, we were taking the cost of the events and spreading them out to people who wanted to purchase these foils and or vendors. Mm-hmm. And it was both making the judges money and making the vendors money. Just scouting that out of people in different ways. And it just puts awkward pressure in different places.
Yeah.
This makes it a little more straightforward as to what's going on. For Legion, we actually decided that we didn't want to go all the way up to 60. We didn't feel like we needed to go all the way to 60 unless we wanted to. We could bump, if we go to 60, we bump the judge compensation quite a bit more. But we decided we didn't want to do that to people who go all the way to 60. So we were doing early registration. And early registration allows you to register. If you register more than a week in advance, you're going to get $5 off. And if you register more than 2 weeks in advance, you're going to get $10 off.
Oh, that seems cool.
Yep. That lets us get a little bit better read on what our space is. And what needs we have, and lets us activate more judges if we need to. And so the thing is, we have to figure as if the humongous majority of people are taking advantage of that. And so with a $50 price point, we did our math. We posted a judge compensation for Omaha, which is coming up as our first event of 2015. That is January 10th and 11th, by the way.
Yeah.
And it is standard. No.
Modern.
It's modern, sorry. Yeah. San Antonio is standard, which is coming up for us in a couple months.
You know, I don't mind paying a little more. I don't know.
Yeah.
Judges get paid. I think that makes sense.
And quite frankly, Grand Prix were probably underpriced anyways. Like, this sounds really mercenary, but when a Star City Open that costs $40 and a GP that costs $40 both exist, and the GP gets over twice as much turnout as the Star City Open, then what that suggests is that the Grand Prix should be priced higher because the value to the players is higher, and so they, like, more people obviously wanted to play in the Grand Prix.
Yeah.
And if the value to you is higher, then we should be pricing it higher. And the, like, Grand Prix are still, for a full day or 2 days, if you day two worth of entertainment, $60 is still really cheap. Like,
yeah.
I think it's, yeah, I would rather judges get paid fairly. Yeah. So that's the update there. Put that in your update and smoke it.
Oh man, I sent my update to the update repair and cleaning shop because it was kind of old and cracked. So I'll have to wait to smoke that update in my update until I get it back from the update repair shop.
Well, thank you, Judge Rob, for coming and talking with us this week.
Yeah.
I feel so much more knowledgeable about rules and just about life in general. I feel like all my problems are solved now that you came and talked to us about magic rules.
Yeah. Good. I feel like what was cloudy is now clear.
Yeah.
What was
murky is now murk-lurky. Murk-lurker. M15 reference. Okay.
Stop it. That set is behind us. We will never talk about it again.
I wish you guys all great luck in playing some more Cons of Tarkir out there in the universe as soon as you can. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you guys know the drill. Chat us up on Twitter at MTAcast. We would love to hear from you. It's a really easy and fast way to get in touch with us, and we'll respond very quickly. It takes us a little while longer to respond to email, but Twitter we get back really fast. So follow us. Join the family. We're almost to 900 followers at MTAcast.
Oh, snap. You can also email us at magictheamaturing@gmail.com or check out our website, magictheamaturing.com.
Sure.
You can send us a Pony Express to our nearest Pony Express stop in Minneapolis. There's just one because it's a failing system.
But still there, still hanging on.
Yep, there you go. So Pony Express Minneapolis.
So no more ponyback brigades?
Well, you know, I feel like it's still got a chance.
I mean, I'm just saying, you have to pay those goblins a lot.
They are really greedy.
They really work you over.
Very greedy.
So.
Yeah, for sure. You can say hi to us online. I'm horny_unicorny.
I am Ice Cream Socialist.
And you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or themeatery.org, where you can also go to read some articles by Megan that she wrote about her magic online bad experience, that rant we had a couple episodes ago. She wrote a couple articles that got huge traction, and Magic, the Wizards team, actually responded. Megan, do you have an update for us?
Oh, yeah. I sure did get that event compensation.
Yeah, so she wrote a huge article about it in Wizards.
I only had to write 1,500 words and get it published, but I sure did get the event compensation I requested.
Oh, God. So, go to themeatery.org to read those articles. They're really good.
Thanks, buddy.
Hey, you're welcome. You're welcome.
As always, have a good week, and fuck you.